You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck on today's show.
New York, a city of beautiful skyscrapers. Paris, a city of light. London, the city of planes. Is that really what we want?
The British government decides to back the expansion of London's Heathrow Airport, but the row over where to build a new runway in the southeast of England is not over yet. My guests, John Everard and Shashank Joshi, will discuss this and the other top stories of the day, which include the dismantlement of the jungle refugee camp in France's Calais, the discussions being held behind closed doors as the Chinese Communist Party's Central Committee gets together, and the price of a pain au chocolat. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, my guests today, I think you can hear them in the background, they're already getting started. Shashank Joshi, who's research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, and John Everard, former British diplomat. John was formerly also the British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both to the programme.
Good evening.
Now, here in the UK, the government has confirmed it's backing a third runway for London's Heathrow. The option was chosen over alternatives, including an expansion of Gatwick Airport and extending one of Heathrow's existing runways. It's hoped the decision would put an end to years of speculation and delay. However, there will undoubtedly be more speculation to come. For example, London's Mayor, Sadiq Khan, has said expanding the West London Airport is the wrong decision for both city and the UK. Shashank, is he right?
I personally did support expansion at Gatwick, although I wasn't overly emotionally invested in the subject of runways in which airport. I was more puzzled, staggered by the vast amounts spent by PR agencies on this campaign over the last several years. Just the incredible money ploughed into persuading people of the merits of one or the other. I was also interested to see the way in which the decision was made, the degree to which MPs were affected by the location of their constituency. And I've been troubled, really, by the way in which this idea of collective cabinet responsibility, you know, this nice quaint idea, is just becoming jettisoned for every controversial subject as we come to it. And I think it's staggering. The Foreign Secretary thinks the decision made by his own government, someone holding a great office of state, thinks it's completely undeliverable. What a bizarre political situation to
be in. So we should just explain that Theresa May, the new British Prime Minister, said that because some people had lobbied so much for certain points, that she would kind of allow kind of easing of collective responsibility. And here he was allowed to kind of say what he wanted to say.
Well, it's not really how a cabinet works. It's not, of course, it's not just Boris. It's also, I think, it's Justine Greening has also expressed significant opposition. I also find it amusing Zach Goldsmith has resigned. Of course, he has a long record of opposition, but this is a government with a majority of four seats, is it? I can't remember if Zach is in an exceptionally safe Tory seat. I guess he is. But I think it's interesting, you know, to watch this majority for a short while remain quite slender. And of course, there will be a vote on this subject.
Just for our listeners who don't know, Zach Goldsmith, he represents Richmond, talking about which is literally under the flight path to Heathrow. And he said that if this went ahead, he would resign and he would stand as an independent. So interesting for the Tories, John, they could lose that seat.
It's possible. Yes, right. Easy to forget that this used to be a Lib Dem seat. So before Zach Goldsmith took it over.
And the Lib Dems are again properly opposed to this expansion of the airport at Heathrow.
That's right, they are. So if a by-election is forced, then yes, I don't think anyone can really predict the outcome.
But on the big point, John, I guess, you know, whatever you think about this, you know, British governments for some years now have just been caught up in such kind of rounds of dither and dodging because they didn't want to make the decision because they knew one way that they'd lose some votes. So they put it off again and again and again and again. And even now, it's going to be a long time before this actually gets voted on and pushed through.
Yes.
But was the final kind of like shove Brexit, do you think? A need to be seen to be investing in the UK?
I think Brexit affects virtually every government decision. So yes, to that extent it was. But I think the dynamics were much more complex than that. I think there was a sense around that if the government didn't make a decision now, that people would effectively give up on the government, that you know, people would decide this was just going to drift and drift and drift. A slow process ahead, as you rightly say. This will now go to public consultation. There will be a parliamentary vote, almost certainly not before this time next year. So winter's 2017-18. If that favours Heathrow, and remember, we can't assume that, then groundbreaking in 2020, nothing is actually going to start flying off this third runway until 2025. And what's the world going to look like then? I mean, it seems to me that the Commission's report is a hostage to so many imponderable variables. Nobody yeah. knows what the economic situation is going to be like at the time. It assumes a steady rise in demand for aviation, particularly on short haul. Is that right? It's also a hostage to technology. New aircraft coming in all the time that make the hub and spoke system on which Heathrow is based redundant. At the moment, if you want to fly from, say, Detroit to, say, Manchester, you probably fly Detroit, JFK, Heathrow, Manchester, or you might be able to cut out one of the hubs there. New aircraft coming in make it viable to fly straight Detroit to Manchester, cutting out Heathrow from a large part of his business. It's not clear to me that the Commission's report gave this significant change in aviation the weight it deserved. And I have this sick feeling that after all this huffing and puffing, we may actually be building a white elephant.
I think I personally don't actually agree with you, because I'm not sure that many people want to fly Denver Manchester anyway, and I think that actually the lure of London in a giant, you know, you're in, even now in Europe, it's such a kind of gateway, and I think that we have been kind of letting ourselves down in that sense. So, you know, even people who say, you know, I know some people say we don't need all this capacity, but when you come into Heathrow, you only have to be a passenger to see how many times you have to circle for like 40 minutes to be able to land, or how many times you're delayed, you know, sitting over Kent because there's no way to get into London. There's a real sense it's kind of chock-a-block already. Shashank.
I think that's just going, returning to your question of the connection to Brexit and the timeline that we just heard about. This is also a sort of counter-cyclical fiscal move in one sense, possibly. Of course, it'll involve vast spending, infrastructure spending, and this could be quite a useful fiscal counterweight to the downturn we may see at that period.
Yeah, sorry, coming back to your point. Yeah, passengers come in with London as a final destination. Yes, London's a gateway to all kinds of places. Yes, absolutely. But I think it's 30-something percent of all flights into Heathrow are connections to other parts of the UK and indeed to other parts of Europe. And as I'm saying, I think with new aircraft, that is likely to stop.
Well, we're going to move now across the other side of the English Channel next. In Calais, French police have just begun dismantling the jungle migrant camp. More than 2,800 former residents have been relocated already to other parts of France by bus since the eviction started on Monday. However, thousands of migrants have vowed to defy orders to leave Calais, saying they want to get to Britain at any cost. Shashank, is this going to solve anything, dismantling this camp?
Well, it'll add hurdles in the way of those attempting to get to the UK, but not in the long run. Of course, you know, the effort required to prevent people from travelling back to Calais, from preventing them from making the attempted journey back to the UK in the long run, is going to be exceptionally hard for the French authorities. And I think we haven't really seen the difficult part yet, which is evicting those most determined to stay from the camp. I think we've seen the very early stages. It's going to get a lot more messy, and this is going to be very high up the headlines for several weeks, I think.
But what do you think the French government's intention is? Because, you know, in recent weeks, you hear one minute, you know, a minister saying the border should be moved to the UK. Yeah, it's a shared responsibility. But in the last couple of days, it seems very hard language coming out of Paris saying, you know, we need to stop this camp. We will not allow people to return once it's dismantled. We owe it to the people of Calais to put an end to this story. It sounds this time as though the French are quite keen to actually put an end to any camp being rebuilt there.
Yes, it does. But of course, the issue of where the border lies is one that's going to come back to us, especially once Brexit negotiations proceed and the issue of flow of people and borders come back onto the political headlines. So I think the French are serious, but of course, it doesn't settle the issue of where the border goes and how the French, how much the French choose to indulge us on that particular question.
Yeah, indulge us. I mean, there is a treaty on this. This is a formal agreement between the two governments, and the French have not very long ago reconfirmed that treaty stands. There are always going to be voices against it for reasons we can all understand. But until the treaty is actually abrogated, that is international law. That is what's been agreed. And that border is going to stay in Calais. Coming to Andrew's question, is it going to change anything? I am so old that I can remember the Songat camp before the Calais jungle was invented. And I remember all the toings and froings over getting rid of that. And sure enough, you know, people were eventually moved to Songat and people thought that was the end of the matter. Not so, of course. A lot of the people who left Songat simply disappeared into hideaways of various kinds for a while and then reappeared to form the nucleus of what later became the jungle. Round and round and round we go. For as long as the UK remains the magnet it is to migrants from all over the world, the pressure is going to be on in France, on the nearest point to the UK, and simply dismantling the camp isn't going to stop that.
John, what do you take of the tone of the argument around this camp? Because, you know, what's strange is, you know, what we're seeing in every country, what we've seen post-Brexit, is this extraordinary kind of, you know, divisive language that's come to the fore. And if you read the comment pages underneath any of the stories that have been posted, even in the kind of the most liberal of newspapers, you read the comments underneath, people are not holding their punches anymore. Either these are all kind of con artists and tricksters trying to get into the country, pretending to be children when they're not. They're all criminals. They're all kind of people that don't deserve any sympathy. Or you are on the other side and you believe that actually these are all good people and we should try and do something about it. There seems to be very little human understanding at the heart of this that bridges the divide.
It is an intensely divisive issue, you're absolutely right. And there's not a lot of meeting of minds, not a lot of grey area in the comments that you read. People are either fiercely for or fiercely against what has been done. I think it's sad that there hasn't been more of a kind of open and informed underlined debate on this. So far, we've had much more a kind of shouting match. The truth, of course, lies between the two. There are well-documented cases of people trying to pass themselves off as Syrians who, in fact, have had nothing to do with that conflict at all. And there are very, very quite heartrending stories of humanity, of human disaster, where I think any rational human being would want to reach out and help the people involved. And there's a lot in between.
I think it's interesting to see politicians who are somewhat more detached from the issue have been able to express that middle ground more clearly. Mm. And someone like Jack Straw, former Home Secretary, has said, look, a very large number of these people are, of course, economic migrants. That's something that I think the liberal wing in this debate has had trouble articulating, conceding, and that has forced them into some awkward positions against the harder line on the other side.
Yeah.
But the notion, Shashank, of the UK being a place of refuge for people fleeing persecution, do you think it has been dented by the language around this issue? Is, you know, some of the things that you read, they're almost inhuman. You know, the comments underneath these stories, there is literally no sympathy for anybody, whatever their story. And, you know, some newspapers have covered the story as though there are no children in the camps whatsoever. And their definition of children seems to be that you need to be probably like 8 and wearing a pink dress. You know, that if you're a 15-year-old boy from Pakistan or from Afghanistan or from Somalia, then you deserve no sympathy.
I think we should be careful about reading too much. I've been reading internet comments for too long, I think, and I can remember these sorts of inhumane comments under any piece on the Middle East or Asia for over a decade. Ministers have been more careful. It's the odd MP, I think, who has expressed themselves in a very imbalanced way, and I think it was with David Davies' impetuous comment on the nature of these migrants. It wasn't that the sentiment was completely wrong. It was expressed in rather a crass way that I think showed a real lack of humanity and sympathy that was the problem. And of course, the post-Brexit environment is sort of that resonates in a rather unfortunate way.
Yeah. You asked just now how this is changing perception of the UK as a safe refuge for people fleeing trouble. I mean, there were interviews done in the jungle just a few days before they closed it. And as far as I can tell from the kind of remarks coming out from the refugees there, the answer to your question is hardly at all. To these people, the UK still remains a kind of nirvana. Part of the problem is that their expectations of what will happen to them if and when they actually get to the UK are completely unmeetable and completely unrealistic.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, John Everard and Shashank Joshi. Coming up next, the devastating attack on a police academy in Pakistan and what will be discussed when the Chinese Communist Party's Central Committee gets together behind closed doors.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield and I'd like to tell you all about a very special edition of The Foreign Desk coming up next month. For the first time, The Foreign Desk will be recorded live in front of an audience here at Midori House in London. We'll have a fantastic panel of guests, all experts in their field, and we've got a topic that will provide plenty for them to get their teeth into.
It's not about us so much as it is about you and your families and the kind of country and future you want.
Taking place a week after the US presidential vote, we'll ask what the election of President Clinton or President Trump means for the rest of the world.
We are going to enforce all trade violations against any country that cheats.
So, we have a topic, we have guests, all that's missing is you. If you'd like to be in the audience, head to monocle.com to buy your ticket today. That's The Foreign Desk Live with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Tuesday the 15th of November at 1900.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and still with me are John Everard and Shashank Joshi. In Pakistan, at least 59 people have died and more than 110 were injured after a team of suicide attackers stormed a police academy in the city of Quetta. A major security operation lasted for hours and all attackers were eventually killed. So-called Islamic State said its fighters had carried out the attack. However, Pakistani officials named another militant group called Lashkar-e-Jhangvi. Shashank, what was your understanding of what happened?
Well, Lashkar-e-Jhangvi is a very nasty sectarian group, which means, of course, it's a Sunni jihadist group. It likes blowing people up, but it focuses its ire on Pakistan's Shia minority. But I think it's also symbolic because it is part of a... It's melted with a whole universe of other jihadist groups in Pakistan. LEJ, in this case, may well have been acting for Islamic State's province in the region, IS Khorasan. But they also have ties to Al-Qaeda, so in a weird way, they sort of bridge this huge Al-Qaeda-IS divide. And they have ties to the Pakistani state, which indulged them because they were very useful in killing Baloch rebels. And LEJ was seen as less dangerous than Baloch rebels. So it sort of symbolizes everything going wrong with Pakistan. But yeah. One thing I always highlight in these cases is we should remember violence in Pakistan is going down. It's at the lowest level in a decade. So these are, in a way, not death spasms, but responses to what has, by and large, been quite a successful Pakistani campaign to limit the activities of some, not all, but some jihadist groups over the last 2 years.
And just tell us, you know, you've hinted there some of the reasons, but why is that violence going down? Is that because there's a more organized campaign from central government? Is it because they're working still in alliance with the Americans? What's the
most fundamental reason is Pakistan has launched a massive military operation in 2014 called Zarb-e-Azab in North Waziristan, which is one of the agencies of the federally administered tribal areas. North Waziristan was previously a sanctuary because it contained a group that the Pakistan army liked very much, the Haqqani Network, which is allied to the Taliban. The Pakistan army still hasn't touched them. It's let them sort of drift away quietly into Afghanistan. But it has pounded militants. And this is why the Pakistani Taliban is splintering. Bits of it are conducting horrible attacks like we've seen in the past 2 years. And other bits are allying with groups like LEJ. So this is a backlash to that effort. But overall, they're doing not a bad job at quite a big cost to themselves.
And just before I bring John in, just tell me what it means for Afghanistan as well across the border. If you're saying it's beginning to secure the border area a little bit, it's getting rid of these areas.
It's not securing the border area. It's squeezing a lot of nasty people into Afghanistan. So actually, it doesn't help Afghanistan at all. And Afghanistan-Pakistan tensions are growing because Pakistan, partly it's an act of sort of displacement to draw away attention from its own support for the Taliban, is saying the Afghan intelligence agency, the NDS, is actually commanding all of these militants and pushing these attacks into Pakistan with India's connivance, which is 99% rubbish.
John, when you listen to this, are you feeling a little bit more optimistic about the story for Pakistan?
Yes, I mean, it's important that violence is going down. I'm so glad the South has made that very clear. It's as well that it is. I mean, Pakistan faces huge other problems. In this studio, we seem to talk a great deal about the spats with India over the line of control in Kashmir, which at any moment could get very nasty and get out of hand. And, of course, you know, Pakistan's internal political situation remains fractious at the best of times. But this bit, at least, seems to be going well. So, fingers crossed, let's continue.
It is worth also mentioning, of course, Quetta is in Balochistan. I mentioned Balochistan partly because China's investing $46 billion there as part of the China-Pakistan economic corridor. So for the Pakistanis, you know, okay, violence is going down. That's good in an abstract sense. But they are terrified that incidents like this, really high profile, really deadly, will push away that investment, make Beijing quite irritated. Because right now, Pakistan's only safety net in the world is China, with the Americans pulling away geopolitically.
But if that investment is effective, does it mean, again, money would come into the region and it could be stabilizing?
The Baloch rebels claim that that money, particularly in the port of Gwadar in the Arabian Sea, isn't going to the Baloch. It's going to others from Pakistan's Punjabi heartland. So there's an ethnic dimension here as well. And as we know from Afghanistan, other cases, injecting large volumes of money into a fractious area can actually exacerbate divisions sometimes rather than heal them.
If the money arrives, I mean...
And if the money arrives, absolutely. Right. You know, this is illusory, some of it, of course, yeah.
Yes, I mean, China has a long and ignoble record of promising vast amounts of money to anybody who'll listen, only a fraction of which ever turns up, sometimes none at all. So, $46 billion, let's actually see the cash arrive.
Well, we're going to stay with China and China's influence. In China, the Communist Party's 18th Central Committee has gathered for its year-end plenum, a four-day behind-closed-doors meeting. According to Chinese media, party management is on the agenda at the meeting. John, what does that mean?
Nothing in particular, which is why they use the phrase, so that they can claim whatever happens at the plenum that it's a victory. The big concern is that Xi Jinping is going to use this, as you say, behind doors, closed doors gathering, as the platform for a power grab. Under the constitution, he is limited to a 10-year term, and everybody on the Politburo, apart from him and Li Keqiang, has now passed 68 years old, which is the official mandatory Chinese retirement age, and so is supposed to leave. But there are big stage whispers that Xi Jinping is going to once again rip up the constitution, that he's going to allow some people to stay on past mandatory retirement age, in particular Wang Qishan, his key ally in the Politburo. If he does, this is yet another step, and quite a serious step, back to the politics of the Mao Zedong era, where, of course, far too much power was concentrated in the hands of just one man. And just the kind of system that Deng Xiaoping swore to eradicate forever in China. He very carefully constructed a collective leadership with collective responsibility, which has run China effectively ever since. And if Xi Jinping manages to turn the clock back to the dictatorship that Mao once exercised, that is very, very bad news, not only for China, but for the rest of us too.
Shasheng, when you've been to China recently, you've seen how effective the country is and where it sits economically. For Xi Jinping to hold on to that kind of power, to have that kind of influence, is it all dependent on continuing to deliver this so-called economic miracle?
Well, I was in China for a week just now, and the economy was a very widely discussed subject. And I thought the Chinese professors and analysts and think tankers and so on I spoke to were actually surprisingly candid, frank about the enormous risks building up, the various price bubbles, non-performing loans, the catastrophes unfolding in the banking sector. And I think also they were surprisingly frank about the paradox that is Xi Jinping grabbing power on this enormous scale, which was evident, you know, on CCTV and in the way the constitutional side as well. But that contrasted with the difficulty he was having in enforcing his diktat onto lots of elements of particularly local government, particularly in the economic area. So these grand pronouncements about what must happen with these economic targets or these factories or these emissions, and the mismatch between that and the actual implementation at local government was quite substantial. So, I mean, I wonder if that gap will begin to show itself somewhere down the line, particularly if power is centralized more and more.
Yes.
And John, just finally, tell us, when these plenums happen, is much really decided at them? Or are they more stage-managed events to show how great the president is?
No. Things really are decided at plenums. The stage-managed events are the National People's Congress. That's the one that plays to the television cameras all the time, and you get a few characters sort of pulling stunts and, you know, keeping the Chinese people amused. Plenums are serious decision-making bodies. It was back in 78 that Deng Xiaoping announced the reforms at a plenum. Last year, the abolition of China's one-child policy, also done at a plenum, and announced almost in passing in the plenum statement at the end, amongst a great pile of other party verbiage. So yes, these things really do matter. And the statement that will come out probably later this week from this plenum will be read very carefully in a lot of capitals.
Well, finally, on today's show, one of France's presidential hopefuls has managed to upset the whole nation when he admitted he had no idea how much a pan au chocolat costs. Jean-François Copé guessed that the price of the chocolate pastry would be somewhere between 10 and 15 cents, whereas the real price is closer to 2 euros. Xiaosheng, is a silly story in a way, but it's incredible how much preparation we know that politicians go through to make sure they're not caught out by, you know, the price of a litre of milk or a loaf of bread. It seems to be a real kind of lightning rod, whether you're with the people or against them.
Well, I remember David Cameron's dashboard with the whole spectrum of indicators from pint of milk, cost of a newspaper, loaf of bread. And in a way, it's a fiction we all collude in, the idea that David Cameron would pop out and buy his own loaf of bread and his own pint of milk. But I think there is a reason for this. We want them to know how much this stuff costs. Because, of course, for those on low incomes, those daily goods make up a far higher proportion of their income than it does for anyone in the middle class or the sort of upper middle classes. So there is a point here. It's a fiction, it's a charade where we pretend they really go out and buy the papers and know how much they cost, and we pretend to accept that and chastise them if they fail to get it right. But actually, participating in that charade, in a way, is a way of keeping them empathetic to the economic struggles of those who do have to think very carefully about whether milk is 90p a pound or a pound 50.
Well, I have to say that I read this story in entirely the wrong spirit. When I discovered that Copé had thought it cost 10, 15 cents and that people were saying actually cost more than a euro, my first thought was that in my favourite patisserie in Paris, if you buy six at a time, it only costs 5 euros. But I thought that might send the wrong signal.
I should point out that John's actually rather lean because he arrives here normally on his bicycle. You may be imagining a very rotund figure.
We refuse to believe you eat that many croissants.
But I guess the fun in this story is also that he wasn't asked the price of a loaf of bread. He was asked
the price
of a pan of chocolate. It seemed to be cut to kind of like the heart of being French, that you were worried about more significant things than just the milk and the daily bread on your table.
Yeah, it's sort of the equivalent Olympus test is, you know, how much is your croissant, your copy of Charlie Hebdo, and your sort of latest Bernard Henri Lévy volume. That's the equivalent. Whereas for us, is of course it's what's the sum.
Yes. I was going to test you, but I bet both of you have blooming well looked up before you came in. Do you know how much a pint of milk costs, or a litre of milk?
Two pints cost £1.15.
I'm glad he bailed me out there.
Yeah,
I'm so glad you asked him first.
But don't you think that the reason that, you know, politicians and all sorts of people don't know the price of things is because actually that's not how you shop. You go with a certain amount of money to spend, and you see if you have enough at the end, or you spend a bit too much. The way people shop these days is imagining a 1950s style shopping list where you're ticking things off and you're calculating as you go around. And I don't think that even people who are impoverished have a chance to add things up as they go around a shop. They think, okay, I just don't have enough money. I'll buy a few things and let's see what that costs. I'm not sure that... Do you think that everybody is acutely aware of the price of everything?
I do. I mean, I as I go around shopping...
Have you got a shopping list?
Yeah, I go to the shopping list and I add up as I go along what it's going to come to, yes. Doesn't everybody? Am I strange this way?
I don't know. I kind of wander in and it's a bit clueless and kind of think I need something to eat and kind of grab a few things and that's about it. I'm not very good at...
I don't think I go in with a specific list in mind, but I do realise if bread is costing me £2 at Waitrose, I'm not going back to Waitrose for a few months, and I'll let that one wear off before I'll go back to Tesco's or whatever else.
Well, very good. Those are the shopping lists of our guests today. I'm not sure about John's five pan of chocolat, but anyway, there you go. But thank you both, Shashen Joshi and John Everard, for bringing us up to speed with that. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Khan, and our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Daniel Giacopelli continues with The Atlantic Shift next. Then the 1900 Hours is Monocle's design show Section D, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 Hours London time. That's 1400 in San Francisco. Midori House, back at the same time tomorrow, of course. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you for listening and goodbye.